The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer and the Washington Post. And before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the Triangle Radio Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we will be reading. They are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. You know, when it comes to travel, there are many ways to get from here to there. Flying and sailing are among the more popular modes of travel, not to mention the automobile. But one man thinks swimming might be the best way for him to accomplish his next big journey. On today's Armchair Traveler, we begin with 5,500 miles, one ocean. Man wants to be first to swim across Pacific. This article written by Rick Meese of the Washington Post and published in the May 27th, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. So let's begin the swim. Jump in. Ben Lecomp, a 50-year-old Frenchman-turned-Texan, will slip into the water Sunday, that's June 10th, off the coast of Kushi, Japan, and start swimming. If all goes as planned, he won't set foot on land for 6 months. In that time, he plans to swim through the largest collection of trash on the planet, great white shark migration areas, through jellyfish and storms, and isolation and monotony. In November, Lecomp hopes to paddle and kick all the way to San Francisco, becoming the first person to swim across the Pacific Ocean, an extraordinary transcontinental quest that's equal parts adventure and science and experiment. "For me, swimming is a passion," Lecomp explained in a recent interview, "but if it's just swimming for pleasure, that's limited. I need to have greater purpose and a bigger vision." It doesn't get much bigger than the Pacific, the world's largest pool, and something Lecomp has been targeting for nearly 20 years. In 1998, he successfully crossed the Atlantic, which earned him a bit of fame. He appeared on the Oprah Winfrey Show and told her, "When I arrived after swimming the Atlantic, my first words were, 'Never again.' Then a few months later, I said, 'No, I need to go back. It's something that I need. It's within me. I need to find another challenge and to push myself.'" It took nearly two decades to reach this point, with plenty of false starts and funding hiccups along the way. The scale and ambition of this crossing is much different than the Atlantic. The Japan-San Francisco trek will measure 5,500 miles, a staged attempt that will take 180 or so days. Swimming from Cape Cod to France in 1998 measured 3,700 miles over 73 days. That swim was never verified by Guinness World Records because Lecomp drifted off course in a boat and didn't necessarily resume his swims at the exact point he stopped them. His new undertaking is much more involved, with financial backing from companies like Seeker, the science-focused digital publisher, and Discovery. He'll have an eight-person crew that will collect and study data on the ocean and Lecomp throughout the journey, picking up 1,000 or so water samples along the way. Lecomp will be accompanied by a 67-foot sailboat, and each day a smaller inflatable motorboat or kayak will lead him in the water, keeping him on course. Lecomp is aiming to swim 8 hours each day, covering 40 miles of choppy waters, and then spending his nights recuperating on the sailboat. He'll try to consume 8,000 calories each day, freeze-dried and canned foods on the boat, and solely liquids during the swim. He'll be outfitted like an electronics store. Lecomp will have a headset that allows him to stay in constant contact with the crew, a waterproof heart monitor that will track every beat, a bracelet that creates a magnetic field to repel sharks, and another on his ankle that measures radioactivity. Lecomp and his team have partnered with more than a dozen research organizations, including NASA, Argonne National Laboratory, and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and they'll be collecting samples to study water conditions, trash content, and how the prolonged exposure affects Lecomp. "My father taught me how to swim in the ocean when I was 5 years old," said Lecomp, who was raised in France but now lives and trains in Austin, Texas. "So the environment and being in the open water has been very important to me my entire life. And now that I am a father, I look at this as a way to do something for my children because I have seen lots of changes in the ocean." The risks are different than the challenges. LeCompte and his crew will closely monitor the changing conditions, and he'll wear a thick wetsuit to help him navigate waters that could reach 50 degrees. In addition, they'll utilize magnetic and electric fields to ward off sharks. I used to ride a motorcycle in Paris, and I can guarantee you there's much more risk in doing that than swimming in the ocean, said LeCompte, a longtime architectural consultant who is now Associate Director of Sustainability Services for Progea, an environmental consulting firm. His training has included 6 hours of continuous open water swimming each day, and he feels comfortable with the physical demands these next 6 months hold. But an adventure like this is really mind over matter, he said. I'm not trying to swim faster than anybody else. I'm just trying to log my time and my hours per day. What is important is knowing what you're going to do with your mind. The key, he said, is not exerting mental energy on the inevitable struggles. He'll have a game plan each morning before he gets in the water, outlining exactly what he intends to occupy his mind for the ensuing 8 hours. In fact, he'll have specific mental exercises scheduled, 1 hour devoted to designing a building in his head, perhaps followed by 2 hours recalling a favorite day. While he might think ahead to life moments waiting down the road, he'll largely draw from specific memories, reliving them as vividly as possible. Maybe it's a birthday party, he said. I try to remember every detail, smell, the noises, was it warm or cold, just as much information as I can remember. Then it becomes easier for your mind to disassociate from your body. My mind can focus on a subject, and my body can focus on what it needs to do. The first couple of weeks figure to be the toughest, he said, as his body adjusts to its new routine, avoiding sugars, waking up in the middle of the night to load up on calories, dropping into the cold water each morning when all he really wants to do is sleep another 2 hours and let his tired muscles recover. In addition to the scientific undertakings, LeCompte hopes his journey will draw attention to the state of the oceans. His route will take him right through the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, the giant mass of floating trash midway between Hawaii and California. Well, we're going to continue our ocean theme, and next we read Associated Press writer Beth J. Harpus' article, Kapalua Bay Beach Tops List of Dr. Beach's Favorites, and this is from the June 6, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. A crescent-shaped beach on the Hawaiian island of Maui got the top slot Thursday, June 1st, issued annually by a Florida professor known as Dr. Beach. Kapalua Bay Beach topped the list released by Stephen Leatherman, a coastal science professor at Florida International University in Miami. And don't worry about that lava-spewing volcano impacting visits to the Kapalua Beach. The Kilauea volcano is on a different Hawaiian island, the Big Island. Leatherman's list even has a second Hawaiian beach on the same island as the volcano, Hapuna Beach State Park, coming in eighth on the list, but Hapuna is on the opposite side of the Big Island. The other beaches on the top ten list are Ocracoke Lifeguarded Beach on North Carolina's Outer Banks, coming in second, followed by Grayton Beach State Park in the Florida Panhandle, Cooper's Beach, Southampton, New York, Coast Guard Beach, Cape Cod, Massachusetts, Lighthouse Beach, Buxton, Outer Banks, North Carolina, Caladese Island State Park, Dunedin, Clearwater, Florida. Then Hapuna on the Big Island, with Coronado Beach, San Diego, California, in ninth place, and Kiowa Beach Walker Park, Kiowa Island, South Carolina, coming in tenth. About that number one beach, Leatherman told the Associated Press that Kapalua is one of his favorite beaches. It's just an idyllic place to visit. What's interesting is a lot of beaches are beautiful but can be dangerous because of big waves. This beach has two arms of hardened lava flows, ancient lava flows, which protect it. So it's really a calm waterway. You don't go there for surfing. You go there for swimming. The water is warm year-round, he noted. Kapalua is also lined with palm trees, has white coral sand and colorful tropical fish, and is perfect for snorkeling. Leatherman says it's easy to reach from the main road by driving through a golf course, but parking is limited. One small caveat on whether visitors to other parts of Hawaii will notice any ill effects from the volcano. Depending on wind conditions, other areas of the Big Island and the other Hawaiian islands could experience volcanic smog known as VOG. Right now, winds are blowing most of it offshore. VOG is not a new issue, by the way. The entire state has experienced VOG on and off since 2008. criteria for the list. Leatherman has been compiling his annual list of top 10 beaches every year since 1991. He uses 50 criteria to evaluate beaches, with the most important categories being water cleanliness, safety, meaning no rip currents or drownings, and management of the beach environment and its facilities. He also looks for fine, soft sand and gives extra points for beaches that prohibit smoking. He doesn't collect water from every beach and test tubes himself, by the way, but he does use data from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to grade the beaches on water quality. Leatherman's list has its origins in a class he taught at the University of Maryland. A student was writing an article for a travel magazine and asked him to come up with a list of the 10 best beaches based on his expertise as a coastal scientist. He began producing his official annual list in 1991, using his 50 criteria and his vast knowledge of U.S. ocean beaches. I had visited every ocean beach in the U.S. for a Department of Interior study, so that gave me the background data set to work from, he said. His goal in producing the list each year, he says, is to reward those beaches which maintain the high quality and the safety areas, but also to encourage other beaches to do the same. He looks for beaches that balance nature with the built environment. But how come so many states with beloved beaches in places like Maine, the Delmarva Peninsula, the Jersey Shore, the Pacific Northwest, and other coastal areas never make the list, while the same names keep turning up year after year? Leatherman says it's all about the math in his categories. Beaches lose points for water that's too chilly, sand that's too coarse, condo towers instead of dunes, riptides and drownings, erosion, and limited public access. Leatherman adds that he doesn't make money from the list. He just finds it interesting to do and hopes that the standards he promotes will encourage other beaches to do the right thing and improve their quality. Interesting journey there, huh? Well, writer Mara Jickis might take issue with the Dr. Beach Top 10 Beaches list. In her article on Guadeloupe, Beautiful Beaches with a Backstory, is found in the Washington Post, March 9th, 2018 issue. Beautiful beaches are like the famous Tolstoy quote about happy families. They're all alike. A far harder thing to find on a tropical island is a beach that makes you think. When we came to Guadeloupe, we thought we wanted the opposite of that, a place where we could think about nothing at all. We planned to sunbathe and relax, and if we were looking for anything more, it was all for the best of the it was for the best off the beaten path and not in the guidebook spot. It could feel like hours and hours alone. We figured it would be soft, sandy, and lined with palm trees, with a vendor selling rum punch nearby. But we found a lot of other things we weren't expecting. Like a perfect sandwich, a mountain that smells like eggs, and a few ancient bones. It's the kind of place where you go to find some frothy, rum-flavored fun and come away with something meaningful instead. Guadeloupe is composed of four islands. The biggest are connected by a land bridge and form the shape of a butterfly. Grande Terre, the flat island with white sandy beaches, is the right wing. Basse Terre, the mountainous volcanic rainforest island, is to the left. And the island, originally called Caracara, Island of Beautiful Waters, by the Caribs, was renamed by Christopher Columbus. It came under French rule in the 1600s when colonists brought slaves to establish sugar plantations. As a present-day overseas department of France, and thus on the Euro, it has its own Afro-Caribbean culture with a hint of Europe, such as the pain chocolat, and you'll find it in bakeries. More important, it has grappled with its history, having opened one of the largest museums dedicated to the history of slavery in the Caribbean. The flight is not much longer than those to well-trod Caribbean island destinations, including the Virgin Islands and St. John's, but American tourists were few and far between during our stay. It might be due to access. There are multiple daily direct flights to and from Paris, but not nearly as many from the United States. You need to know a bit of French to get around as well. You'll also need to rent a car, and most of the available rentals have a stick shift. My husband and I flew to Pointe Pitre. Pointe Pitre, I should say, and I'm no entomologist, but I call the capital city the butterfly's thorax, right as the sun was setting. We set off for the first stop on our list of the island's most beautiful spots, the tiny harbor town of Deschaux, at the top of the left wing. We drove there in the dark. The view the next morning at the beach of Fort Royal, just outside of town, would be a surprise. Picture turquoise water lapping at the sand, bookended by cliffs that drop directly into the ocean. Another wind-whipped beach on the other side of the resort was empty of people, and we could see the island of Montserrat in the distance. It was pristine, a textbook perfect beach, the Danube of beaches. Imagine starting your trip with this, knowing that there are somehow even better beaches. The first day, and every day after, we'd roll down the windows and blast Bell Radio, a local station that plays Zouk, a Caribbean music genre that sounds like it's drenched in sunlight, and drive to another beach in search of our perfect spot. First, Plages de la Grande Anse, a bustling beach shaded with palm trees, serviced by several beachside shack restaurants and food trucks, then Plage des Perles, which was quieter and more secluded. Everything moves slowly on the island except cars. Basse Terre's main roads hug the coastline and the sides of steep hills. No guardrails. And we would regularly pull over to let others going faster than the posted 70 kilometers per hour around hairpin curves pass by. Deschaux, we later learned, was one of the most remote parts of the island, only connected by road about 50 years ago. It is the kind of charming place where you might spot a flyer asking for help finding a lost pet. Upon closer inspection, see that the fugitive animal is a peacock named Sidoni. At nearly every Guadeloupe beach, you'll find stands selling bocket, a sandwich that is the island specialty. If some entrepreneurial food truck owner took them on as a concept in the United States, they'd have an instant hit. Take a piece of fried dough about the shape and size of a pita and stuff it full of meat or fish, vegetables, a peppery sauce, and maybe an egg, and you have a bocket. Moru crudites, or spicy salted cod with vegetables, was our favorite lunch. For dinner, restaurants offered more elaborate dinners of langouste, spiny lobster, lambe, conch, and fish topped with sauchin, literally dog sauce, a mixture of onions, garlic, lime, and hot peppers that some say gets its name from a spicy bite. And everywhere we went, we had locally made rum. We cooled the fire of our sauchin with the island's traditional drink, Thai punch, short for petite punch, a cocktail made by pouring seemingly any amount of white rum, agricole, into a cup, muddling some cane sugar and lime in with it. It's a do-it-yourself endeavor. Order one Thai or tea punch. At some restaurants, trusting servers just drop off a tray with all the ingredients, including a whole bottle of rum. What an afternoon that must be, huh? The highest point on Basse Terre is a volcano called La Grande Soufrière. And another day, we drove the sunny Zouk music, a contrast to the perilous cliffside roads, to see what the island looked like from its peak. The best way to get to La Grande Soufrière is to put a Le Bain Jaune into your GPS. Instead, the yellow baths are our natural hot springs that welcome you to a well-maintained trail with railings and stone steps in a few particularly tricky parts. It will take you above the tree line, past canyons covered in yellow moss, and then above the clouds to the peak of the volcano, which has the sulfurous smell of rotten eggs. Back at the trail base, other hikers had stripped down to their swimsuits and were contentedly soaking in the bathwater temperature Bain Jaune. It had all the makings of a perfect spot. The smell of rainforest, the sound of birds, the comfort of a warm dip exactly at the time we needed it. That is, until we read a sign nearby in French. Attention à l'imbi. It said, warning of the chance of brain-eating amoebas in the water, and advising guests not to put their heads underwater. The mostly French swimmers, who were up to their necks, seemed unfazed. We didn't go into any more than ankle deep. There were postcard perfect sandy white beaches in Grande Terre, the other half of the island, so we drove southeast across the butterfly's wings to a city called Saint Anne, leaving behind the solitude of Basse Terre for an Airbnb on the edge of town, within walking distance of beaches brimming with French tourists and numerous restaurants. It was even easier to bop around from beach to beach here, where destinations are a little closer together. There was a morning spent on the city beach, where there are boats for rent, and the Fleuve Tropical Fruit ice pops we came to love. There was another day at the Plage de Caraval, the Chichi peninsula-shaped beach of Club Med, with shallow turquoise water and views of La Soufrière in the distance. And there were the few magical hours we spent at the Plage de Bois Jolan, a beach that had no bucket vendors, no tea punch or tie punch, and somehow, miraculously, no other people. We thought the spot, no spot, could possibly surpass it. And it's true that none of the beaches that came after were ever as perfect, as relaxing, as completely pristine as that one. But as nice as it was to lie on that beach and listen to the waves, it wasn't a feeling we could take with us. It was as shallow as that turquoise water. We went to Plage de Raison Claire, the beach of light grapes, inscrutably because we'd heard that it had been filled with good food trucks. The beach was striking. On the other side of the road were the black and white tiled mausoleums of a beautiful old Catholic cemetery. So, when we approached a large sign that said Cimetière Colonial de la Plage de Raison Claire, that's what we assumed it was referring to. A sign described an old cemetery from the 1800s that was unearthed by beach erosion in the 1980s. With my basic level French, I puzzled out the phrase, Ne pas collecter, ni extraire des ossements, or do not collect the or extract the bones. Bones. We looked at each other and then down. A few feet away, there was a bone lying in the sand. Someone probably put it there as a prank, my husband offered feebly. It's probably a goat bone. It was not. We walked further out into the beach where people were sunbathing and drinking Thai punch and saw a barricaded sand dune that contained an active archaeological site. Up close, you could see ribs sticking out. Farther out, some tiny bones that may have been fingers, a partially uncovered pelvis, the undeniable ball-shaped cap to a femur. Dormez tranquille, sleep well, an older Frenchman joked to me. Seeing my reaction, a mix of morbid fascination and alarm, in the United States, such a shite would be shielded from children, the bones exhumed at once and transferred to a proper resting site. In Guadeloupe, tourists went swimming in Red Magazine, where the island's history was poking out of the sand. Maybe it was a memento mori, a poignant reminder that vacation doesn't last forever, but I'm not the type of person who can usually or casually sunbathe near ghosts. It started to rain. It was our last day. We got in the car and queued up Bell Radio, as if it could magically bring the sun back. It didn't. So we did what we did every day. We started to drive to another beach. We drove all the way to the edge of the butterfly's lower right wing, a spit of land that we hadn't seen mentioned in any of the travel stories we'd read about Guadeloupe. All we knew was that it was called Pointe des Châteaux, Tip of Castles, that we'd be surrounded by water on three sides when we reached it, and it would be the last place we'd see on this trip, so it would have to be meaningful. It was. It was a place where we watched clouds roll in over the nearby island of La Désirée and felt the wind whip through towering rocks, where 20-foot waves crashed over the rugged shore and sent salt spray toward us as we climbed stone steps toward a small peak with a cross on top, where we stood and could see half the island behind us in a scene that looked like a Turner painting in front of us. The kind of work made when the world had not yet fully been explored, depicting an ocean that inspires fear and awe in equal measure, where we thought about how we had seen a lot of beaches that week, but never one that made us feel anything like this. Wow. North Carolina's Outer Banks has long been a favorite for beach lovers and coastal dwellers, as well as visitors. And Martha Wagner of the Associated Press is going to update us on a very special Outer Banks site in her article, Land Deal to Save Site Linked to Lost Colony, and it's from the May 13, 2018 issue of the News and Observer. Efforts to unravel the mysterious fate of North Carolina's fabled lost colony could benefit after a preservation group took out its first ever loan to buy a coastal tract where some colonists may have resettled hundreds of years ago. The 16th century English colonists who vanished after being left in the New World have piqued popular imagination and intrigued historians for centuries. One North Carolina community even held a lost colony festival recently. The preservation of land linked to their disappearance could enable future researchers to shed new light on the historic riddle. The 1,000-acre property is so special historically and ecologically that the North Carolina Coastal Land Trust decided to take a risk and borrow $5.3 million for a real estate deal, said Lee Leidy, an attorney and Northeast Region Director for the Trust. It's the first time in 26 years that the Trust has done so. The Trust plans to turn the property over to the state eventually, preserving it for future study. It was a veritable time capsule of important historical events, Leidy said. In addition to being the place where historians now believe some of the colonists resettled, the land in rural Bertie County has been home to an Indian village and to the plantation of Governor Thomas Pollock, who served two stints as governor in the early 1700s. The land, which includes 3.5 miles along Salmon Creek, is important ecologically with floodplain forest of cypress gum swamp and bottomland hardwood forest. The military also uses the area as a central training route and supported the preservation, Leidy said. The nonprofit trust, which has preserved almost 70,000 undeveloped acres since 1992, purchased the land last year and plans to pay off the loans with money from grants. While there's no timetable for turning the property over to the state, an official from the North Carolina Division of Parks and Recreation will visit the site Monday, and that would have been May 14th, Leidy said. England's ill-fated first settlement in North America was established in 1587 when 116 colonists or English settlers landed on Roanoke Island in what is now North Carolina, led by explorer John White. He left them there when he sailed back to England that year for more supplies. When he returned in 1590, delayed by war between England and Spain, none of the colonists remained. White knew the majority had planned to move 50 miles into the main, as he wrote, referring to the mainland. The only clues he found about the fate of the other two dozen were the word Croatoan, carved into a post, and Crow, lettered on a tree trunk, leading historians to suspect they moved south to live with American Indians on what's now Hatteras Island. Archaeologists now believe that some found their way to the land in Bertie County. The possibility first came to light in 2012 when researchers at the British Museum in London announced they had found a drawing of a fort that had been obscured under a patch on a map of Virginia and North Carolina drawn by White in the 1580s. The drawing placed the fort in an area of Bertie County where archaeologists had found colonial-era English pottery and signs of a Native American village. While the area is best known for its probable lost colony connection, it has more pottery shards from the Indian village of the Metaquam than from the Europeans, said Nick Lucchetti, co-vice president of the First Colony Foundation, the group leading the archaeological dig on a parcel known as Site X. The Native Americans are a hugely important part of history, said Phil Evans, president of the foundation. We tend to take a Eurocentric view, but that site can tell a whole century of North Carolina history from 1584 to the Tuscarora Wars of the 1700s. It's a century of North Carolina history that's often forgotten because there are no standing structures for people to see, he noted. Lucchetti and Evans believe perhaps up to 12 members of the lost colony settled on Site X. And they do have a wonderful photograph of archaeologists working on that site and showing some of the things that they're uncovering as they continue their dig. And so we'll definitely have more to come. But right now, we have to tell you it's time to end our journey on today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We hope you'll be listening next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, the content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org, and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.